Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the leaders of West Virginia teachers' unions say that they will remain out on strike after the state Senate voted to cut the 5% pay increase they negotiated with the governor. Meanwhile, teachers in Oklahoma are discussing a strike inspired by West Virginia. Is this the beginning of a wave of teacher activism? Next, today is the last day of the NAFTA talks between Canada, Mexico, and the United States. After intense anti-NAFTA rhetoric on the campaign trail, President Trump has now taken the position that if what he calls a new and fair NAFTA agreement can be agreed upon, then he'll exempt our two neighboring countries from the steel and aluminum tariffs. Then the Israeli extreme right has a high profile at the ongoing annual conference of AIPAC, the largest pro-Israel lobby in the country, with the seminar being held today headlining some of the biggest names in the pro-settler movement. This comes hours before Netanyahu and Trump are scheduled to meet here in Washington, with confrontation with Iran high on the agenda. And then, in the first visit of high-ranking South Korean officials to North Korea since Kim Jong-un took office in 2011, South Korea's National Security Office Director and its intelligence agency head led a 10-person delegation to North Korea to discuss a potential historic meeting of the leaders of both Koreas. And finally, Venezuela's presidential election, which had been scheduled for late April, has been postponed until May 20th. As a faction of the opposition breaks ranks and decides to participate, will the country's Bolivarian revolution continue? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to the West Virginia teacher strike. The leaders of West Virginia's teachers' unions say that they will remain out on strike after the state Senate voted to cut the 5% pay increase they negotiated with the governor. Meanwhile, teachers in Oklahoma are discussing a strike inspired by West Virginia. Is this the beginning of a wave of teacher activism? We're joined from Washington by Liz Davis, president of the Washington Teachers Union, who has taught in D.C. public schools for 41 years, and by Dr. Curry Malott, a professor of education at Westchester University in Pennsylvania, where he is the mobilization chair of the faculty union. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Liz, let's start with you. West Virginia's education system is ranked 48th in the country. Oklahoma's is ranked 49th, and now Oklahoma's teachers are talking about going on strike. The only education system that's worse is Kansas, and that's where Governor Brownback has actively tried to dismantle public education. Do you think that this is something of a wave? Are we going to see more teacher strikes elsewhere around the country?
I believe we are, and of course, this Janus case is not has actually fueled the fire. You know, the fact that the teachers, when we think about the valuable work that they do for children in this country, well beyond what they're hired to do, ranging from nurses to, and now basically first responders. So teachers are, they're fed up. And of course, even though we're in a school district that is supposedly one of the highest paying in the nation, teachers are just as frustrated. So we are quite proud of the fact that the West Virginia teachers have taken the stand. And we would expect to see more of that. Somehow, and especially in D.C., I've recently left a meeting of labor leaders, and teachers, of course, have reached a point where they've said enough is enough. We have basically gone along to get along, and this strike that is happening in West Virginia is actually fueling, sparking the fire in teachers in D.C. who have been rallying around a number of issues, even though we have pay raises that were recently given. It was after 5 years. The 1% that is being offered in West Virginia is a slap in the face, not only to West Virginia teachers, but to all of us that teach. So I do believe that this is the beginning of a wave.
Let's turn now to Dr. Curry Malott. Curry, you know, it's West Virginia and maybe Oklahoma. These are places that are, you know, while, of course, West Virginia had a long history of labor activism, it certainly hasn't been the tradition in recent years of sort of leftist progressive activity. It reminds me a little bit of what happened in the 1950s, where the struggle began not where you would might think it would be easiest in New York or in Washington or San Francisco or, you know, the big cities. It started in Montgomery, Alabama. In other words, a movement began where conditions were harshest and where the possibilities seemed the most remote, and yet started there. And that led to a nationwide movement, first a regional movement, then a nationwide movement. Certainly, education is a civil rights, not just a labor movement, but a civil rights movement. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some important similarities between Mississippi and West Virginia in terms of, the civil rights movement didn't begin where it was easiest, but it began where people who were enslaved led the movement against slavery. And I think that history was not forgotten and helped to lead the way in the Black liberation theology that came out of the slave era. Continues to serve as a vehicle, an organizing vehicle. And I think the same thing in West Virginia is that there's a long history of militant labor action that is not forgotten. It is remembered. And a lot of the teachers identify not as professionals, but as workers. And that spirit of rebellion is emerging again. You know, but I think this kind of goes back even to 2010 in Chicago, when the teachers began to caucus in Chicago. And, you know, the shift in capital's labor needs and the defunding of education and teachers becoming increasingly frustrated with a leadership model in their union that trades obedience for a decent contract. And those decent contracts are becoming fewer and fewer, and the payoff just isn't there anymore, and teachers are becoming increasingly frustrated. And so I think it started in Chicago, it spread to Seattle. It's now it spread to Philadelphia, where the teachers began to caucus a couple of years ago. Now it's in West Virginia and spreading to Oklahoma. So yeah, I agree that this is spreading, and it's going to continue to spread as Janus passes, as the effects of the Trump tax plan are felt by more and more people. I think this is only going to escalate the crisis of capitalism as we move forward, and teachers are leading the way.
One of the things that really has struck me is the unanimity that we've seen in West Virginia. It's every single county in the state. We're talking about 277,000 students, all 55 counties. And we're talking also about three different unions, but they've all stuck together here. And as you just said, we saw it in Philadelphia, we saw it in Chicago, and now we may be seeing it in Oklahoma. I can't help but to think that this could herald the rebirth of teachers' unions around the country.
Liz, go ahead, because you're here in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital. One would think, because there's such affluence in this area, that things are great and the schools must be great. But of course, that affluence is concentrated in certain communities, and certainly the public schools in the District of Columbia and teachers in particular not only are suffering, but teachers have been largely demonized and targeted as if they were the problem. And as a consequence, teachers are angry. Go ahead.
Absolutely. And the good thing about it, just as in Chicago, the alliance forged between parents and education stakeholders and the union was just amazing. When the parents are beginning to see that some of the reforms that are being put in place by the Trump administration, this whole notion of privatizing public education, defunding the public schools and demonizing them, starving basically the schools to the point where we can justify replacing them with a privatized charter school system. Parents and teachers are catching on to that. So there's an intersection of understanding that the public schools of right need to be protected. And parents are getting that. So forging that alliance with parents has strengthened the unions in West Virginia and Chicago. When during that strike in Chicago, you saw parents out there with the teachers and other. So the whole, and of course, although we are an affluent city, it does not mean that affluence is for teachers. Teachers, at least 60% of our members cannot afford to live in the district. And of course, after going for 5 years without a pay raise, parents began to advocate for teachers, the teachers of their children, to get pay raises. That strengthened our campaign to get our contract finished. So this, and of course, this Trump DeVos administration is adding fuel to the fire. It's coming down, top down. Reform strategies, top-down defunding of public schools, and they're beginning to see a pattern that is intended to basically destroy unions as well as public education, the public education system. And of course, that is going to strengthen the movement. Teachers are, they have stronger, more powerful allies than parents and other community stakeholders, they who no longer see the union as being a roadblock to reform, but seeing it as being a civil rights organization, an organization that fight for the rights of students, for quality teaching and learning, and for safe, high-quality schools in every community. So that alliance is really going to help teachers a lot. And the magical thing about the West Virginia strike, I must say this, on my computer morning, noon, and night, this morning, the number of teachers from across the nation, including our own local, who are supporting those teachers in West Virginia from as far as California, who set up funds for pizza, funds to raise money to pay while they're out on strike. That signals that there is a lot of solidarity between unions across borders.
Dr. Curry-Millott, the Washington Post reported recently that it's possible to be an adjunct professor at several different universities here in town, George Washington, American, Georgetown, and to still live below the poverty level, making anywhere between $1,500 and about $3,500 per class per semester, with no benefits, I might add. Do you see this idea of organizing and striking at the university level as a possibility? We have about a minute left.
Yeah, no, that's happening as well. You know, I was talking about public school teachers caucusing. It's starting to happen. You know, it's starting to happen at universities as well, and adjuncts are becoming more organized. You know, I think there's a good book by John Marsh called Why We Can't Teach or Learn Our Way Out of Poverty, that we can increase the educational attainment, but that's not going to have an overall impact on the rate of poverty. And there's something inherent about capitalism that I think needs to be addressed a little bit more concretely in this really important movement that teachers are at the forefront of, that is, you know, that we've been talking about. It really is a progressive advance that we really should support. But there's something else about capitalism itself that we have to tackle. We have to confront.
Well, it's something we're definitely going to be talking about in the very near future. We're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. We're joined from Washington by Liz Davis, president of the Washington Teachers Union, who has taught in the D.C. public schools for 41 years, and by Dr. Curry-Millott, a professor of education at Westchester University of Pennsylvania, where he's the mobilization chair of the faculty union. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We will be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today is the last day of the NAFTA talks between Canada, Mexico, and the United States. After intense anti-NAFTA rhetoric on the campaign trail, President Trump has now taken the position that if what he calls a new and fair NAFTA agreement can be agreed upon, then he'll exempt the two neighboring countries from the steel and aluminum tariffs. We're joined from New York by Pete Dolak. He's an activist and writer with Trade Justice New York Metro, who focuses on human rights, social justice, and environmental and trade issues. And he's also the author of It's Not Over, Learning from the Socialist Experiment. And we're joined from California by Jack Rasmus, a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California, and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. And you can also read more of his writings at jackrasmus.com. Welcome to both of you, gentlemen.
Glad to be here.
As well.
Jack, let's start with you. It seems to me that Donald Trump is winging this. Not a lot of thought went into this decision to levy tariffs on steel and aluminum. And at the same time, we know that the president did not consult with the Secretary of the Treasury. He did not consult with congressional leaders. The ambassadors, the U.S. ambassadors to Canada and Mexico had no idea that this decision was coming down. Do you think he'll be able to pull back from this and somehow declare victory?
Well, first of all, you got to understand that Trump is a free trader. He's just a bilateral free trader. He's for individual negotiations. He's not against NAFTA. He wants to tweak NAFTA to benefit the business interests. But most important, all this tweet stuff is really playing to his base in an election year. And also, of course, we had an election going in Mexico. So nothing's going to be really resolved here until after the November election. This isn't the end of negotiations on NAFTA. This is just just the beginning. And it's all tactical and an attempt for him to inject himself into the negotiations. And as you said, totally surprise the rest of them. So he can look to his base like he's doing something on this issue, which he's not going to do anything, try to take some claim for something that, isn't going to really happen. This is a pattern with him. You see him, he tweets or he comes on TV, he says one thing, and 24, 48 hours, he flips and he does something quite different. And all these tweets really mean nothing. They upset the markets. They upset the negotiators. But this is just Trump trying to inject himself in a process that the elites really control and will continue to control, and him trying to get some credit for something. It's not real. It's not. No change is really going to happen. There will be some tweaking to NAFTA, but in no way is NAFTA, the elites, Ryan and all the rest, are going to let NAFTA and free trade slip from them.
Right.
Interesting points. That's Jack Rasmus. Pete Dolek is our other guest. Pete, what do you think? Do you agree with Jack?
I definitely agree with Jack. I think if we were to describe this whole process in a single word, it would be farce. There's no way Trump is going to do anything do anything other than a minor tweak of NAFTA, as Jack said. I think he is indeed playing for his base. Today he set off another round of tweets. It's almost as if he wakes up in a bad mood and decides to get out some tweets to get it off his chest, I guess, where he said today, no, we're not going to exempt Canada and Mexico unless we get this so-called better deal. But what are they negotiating? They're not negotiating a better deal. They might negotiate a minor tweak on this or that. Maybe one particular industry might get a slightly better deal. But that's it. There's certainly going to be nothing in fundamental or anything real change to anything to do with environmental rules, labor rules, wages. So all the downward pressure on wages, all the movement to make it a clean sweep for multinational capital at the expense of working people, and that's not going to change whatsoever.
You know, we're seeing that around the world, really. We're not seeing a broad new deal with China. We're not seeing a broad new deal with Japan or with South Korea or any of our other major trading partners. I think you're absolutely right. We're looking at minor tweaks here, which is not what Donald Trump promised during the campaign. So, Jack, is the bottom line that these tariffs are going to remain, or that the tariffs are going to be done away with?
Be done away with. There'll be a tweak here or there, but nothing really major is going to change. You know, you got to put this whole trade thing in a broader perspective, and that is, except for the recent few months, which is just temporary, global trade is slowing down. And that means that all these major segments of the global capitalist economy are beginning to maneuver with each other to try to protect their share. Europe and Japan and China and North America and so forth, a lot of maneuvering going on. And that's why you have trade and currency issues coming to the fore here. They're all trying to protect their share of the pie, which isn't growing very much. And probably soon we'll start actually shrinking when we have the next global contraction, which is coming soon. So you got to put all this in that perspective. As far as any change going on in terms of the tariffs and so forth, it'll be, a token here, increase, and a token there, cut and so forth. And Trump will claim before the election that he's achieved something. He may even come out and throw, a bombshell over the transom here, and saying that he's going to retreat from NAFTA, say it even more vehemently than he has right before the November elections. But it won't mean anything. A good example is what's happened with the stock market. You know, he said something last Thursday and Friday. There were, the stock market had a big hiccup. But then over the weekend, all the real elites clarified all this don't mean anything, and the stock market's back up. So Trump is not really running the government. He's not really a president. He's sitting up there in the White House and he's tweeting and he's trying to inject himself into the policy. But the real elites are pretty much ignoring him. But the press picks this up and, it shakes up the media. It's a good story for a day or two, and then everything settles back down.
I think a lot of that was going on. I think if anybody's in charge of anything in the White House, it's probably Mike Pence. And obviously he's got his cabinet, he's got his advisors, and I think, he gets up in the morning in a bad mood, sends out some tweets, and then his staff gets to work on him and starts whispering in his ear and says, oh, boss, you're such a stable genius, but, what about this? And they kind of guide him back off to where his default position is, which obviously is to serving the class that he's a representative of. Even if some of that class would have preferred Hillary Clinton and the Democrats to have been in power as opposed to Trump himself, nonetheless, they've quite clearly made their peace with him and realized, hey, we can get a hell of a lot out of this guy. And at the end of the day, what is Donald Trump doing? You see, consistently, no matter what his rhetoric is, no matter what he promised his base, he does what multinational capital and the most powerful industrialists and financiers in this country want him to do, and he's done that pretty consistently. And then you look at trade. He's already dropping a lot of hints. He's wants back into the Trans-Pacific Partnership. All along, they still are negotiating quietly on the side, the transatlantic agreement with the European Union. And so the most secret trade deal of them all is called the Trade and Services Agreement, with 50 countries, not only with the NAFTA countries and all the European Union, but Japan and a lot of the countries in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and even some countries outside of it, large developing countries like Indonesia. And that would literally outlaw regulations on the financial industry. Any financial industry company could go into any country and essentially take over the financial system, and the government would not be able to do that. They're full speed ahead with all of those things. So whatever is going on, or this or that, whoever was going to fall out with NAFTA, there's plenty of these other deals still out there, and they're still full square with that. So much vigilance is needed here.
Let me ask you, Jack, because I don't want to play devil's advocate fully, but just a little bit, or maybe I'm not playing devil's advocate because maybe the two of you fully agree with this. But yes, Trump is part of the sort of dominant economic class in America. But there are debates that go on, and there are divisions. There is Gary Cohn on the one side, Goldman Sachs banker, representing the neoliberal globalist capitalist policy. At the same time, you have elements like Peter Navarro, who's ascending, it seems, in the White House, who's what it's called in popular vernacular, trade hawk, meaning an America first, or not as keen on multilateral, or even, let's say Jack mentioned the preeminent position of bilateral agreements. But is there a debate going on inside the Trump administration, or is it your position, Jack, that this is all just smoke and mirrors to position Trump for the elections?
Well, there was a debate going on. The wing of the capitalist class that put him in, finance capital and so forth, shadow bankers, et cetera, and their shadow bankers are running the U.S. economic policy. Cohn was mentioned, Goldman Sachs CEO, and Mnuchin, he's from Goldman Sachs, and Bill Dudley at the Fed, he's from Goldman Sachs. That group is really running economic policy. And at times Trump jumps in and tweets and so forth. But, they put it back on track the way they wanted. Dulles was correct about the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership. Japan has taken the lead on behalf of the U.S. They're continuing negotiations. And at some point, the U.S. will rejoin them after elections. And they'll continue with that negotiation. Who's really running the policy? Yes, there are debates, but that whole wing, that hawk wing, has been really driven back.
We're out of time. We're going to have to leave it right there. We were joined from New York by Pete Dolak. He's an activist and writer with Trade Justice New York Metro. And we were joined from California by Jack Rasmus, a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Israeli extreme right has a high profile at the ongoing annual conference of AIPAC, the largest pro-Israel lobby in the country, with a seminar being held today headlining some of the biggest names in the pro-settler movement. This comes hours before Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump are scheduled to meet here in Washington, with confrontation with Iran high on the agenda. We're joined from Washington by Miko Peled. He's the author of The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Miko has a new book that's coming out next month called Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Miko, welcome back.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
So, Miko, there's a love fest that's going to take place this afternoon at the White House between Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump. Could we expect anything good or anything productive to come out of this meeting?
Well, I think a lot of good is going to come out of the meeting for Netanyahu. I mean, every time he meets with Donald Trump, he comes out with some kind of a gift or a political gift is given to him in one way or another. And so I think for Netanyahu, this is going to be another one of these wonderful meetings where he's going to come out feeling stronger and then returning back home, face corruption charges, which are going to be tough. It's going to be tough to prosecute him because he's so strong politically. And every time he comes to America, he comes back with these enormous political gifts. So I think for him, this is definitely going to be a good day.
Brian, this is exactly the same point that was made on the morning news programs this morning, that Benjamin Netanyahu has nothing to lose, only things to gain with this meeting. And this meeting comes at a time where for the first time, a majority of Israelis, more than 50% of Israelis, are saying that Netanyahu ought to resign because he's facing these corruption charges. Miko, is there any chance of Netanyahu resigning, especially if he returns to Israel with, as you correctly note, what will likely be a gift from Donald Trump?
I mean, there's always a chance. Three state witnesses, there's three of his top advisors that have turned state witnesses now and are agreeing to testify against him. But he seems unshakable, immovable. Politically, he's very strong. The decision to prosecute is a political decision by the attorney general, who he nominated. You know, it remains to be seen. It all depends how strong politically he is, I think, at the end of the day, more than any proof that the police might come up with to solidify an indictment. It's going to be how strong he is politically. And this trip to the U.S., you know, all of his trips to the U.S. always end up with him coming back like Caesar marching into Rome. You know, I mean, he's strong, he's powerful, he seems undefeatable. All the other politicians seem like, you know, just children running around, not really knowing their head from their feet. And he walks in with all these accomplishments that are really hard to defeat. So we'll see what happens. I mean, anything is possible, but I don't think it's very likely that he's going to be resigning.
Miko, there's a conference going on today outside the Washington Convention Center. It's going to be at the 6th and I Synagogue, which is really a fantastic and important place for speeches or similar events to take place. You know, I've been down to the 6th and I Synagogue to see astronauts and politicians and famous authors, and it's really a great place. But this event is going to be something different. Tell our listeners about that.
Well, I think this is a gathering of the worst racists, the worst violent murderers, the worst liars, I think, since, I don't know, Benito Mussolini or something. I mean, I can't imagine a more despicable group of people under one roof at one time. It's headed by Strategic Affairs Minister Gilad Erdan and Naftali Bennett. You know, they're charged with, Erdan is charged with combating BDS and the delegitimization of Israel. And that's really the theme of the meeting, how to combat the delegitimization of Israel, particularly through the embrace of Judea and Samaria, which is what used to be called the West Bank. So, I mean, these are the most racist, the most violent, the most despicable group of people they could put together, all who are here, I suspect, for the AIPAC conference. And it's a shame. I think it's an embarrassment to the 6th and I Synagogue that they're allowing this gathering. It's an embarrassment that they're allowing these people, that they're giving them a platform. Racists and liars such as those should not be given a platform anywhere, let alone such a respectable venue. And I would expect that eventually the synagogue is going to be very much embarrassed that they allowed them to step inside and spew their hate and spew their lies.
One thing that was notable about the American-Israeli Political Affairs Convention this year and last year and the year before, and it's increasingly so, is that the convention center in Washington starts to feel more and more like a fortress, ringed by barricades and by police, which would not have been the case 15 years ago or 10 years ago. because the political mood has shifted in the United States, or is shifting. It's a dynamic process whereby even the left 15 years ago, not all of it, but most of it, considered Palestine and the Palestinian struggle for self-determination and justice and anti-colonialism to be a taboo, unlike the struggle in South Africa or El Salvador or Vietnam, which garnered the sympathy of progressive people. It was really a taboo. And that was because big parts of the even progressive semi-left were, you know, understood that if you spoke out against Israel, you'd be immediately labeled as an anti-Semite, thus maybe in the camp with fascists, certainly a vile form of racism or discrimination against a people or a religion, anti-Semitism. But now, Amika, we have a situation where public opinion really is turning. So when you see this conference, this, as you said, racist conference going on at the synagogue, the Sixth and I synagogue today, their headline is defensive in character. It says it invites the people to combat the delegitimization of Israel through the embrace of Judea and Samaria, meaning an even more far-right, you know, conquistador sort of orientation towards the West Bank. But they're afraid of delegitimization. Nobody in the Israeli political body politic had to worry about delegitimization 15 years ago. Go ahead.
Yeah, you're right. At the same time, you know, I agree with you. They're fighting a losing battle, and they're using all of their resources in order to fight against a movement that is, I believe, undefeatable, which is the movement to delegitimize Israel and to to call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions and isolation against the state of Israel. And so they've really gathered their you know, the cream of the crop in terms of the Israeli right. And here they are speaking about this and discussing this. But they always seem to construct this in a way as though once again the Jews are being delegitimized. You know, the Holocaust is impending, anti-Semitism is everywhere, and here we are defending ourselves. And the key to our defense, a key to defending us against this delegitimization, is embracing Judea and Samaria. You know, they're very smart in the way they put this together, the way they construct the title, and the way they construct their conversation. On the one hand, we're undefeatable, we're strong, we're here for eternity. On the other hand, look at all these anti-Semites who want to delegitimize us, and you know, we have to stay strong, and so on and so forth. And again, they bring in the issue of Judea and Samaria as though to say, well, if anybody's still talking about the Judea and Samaria as the West Bank or as a possible Palestinian state, you know, then that is further delegitimizing all of us. So they're kind of pulling in all these other motives or motifs into this weird, you know, picture that they're painting. But they are fighting a losing battle. I agree with you on that.
Yeah, and when I say it looks like a fortress, it's because there are more and more demonstrations and more people. It's not because of a military threat to the APEC conference. It's because people really have become enraged. I mean, the United States government spends more financing and subsidizing Israel through economic and military aid than any other country. American taxpayers spend $10 million per day to subsidize what amounts to an apartheid state. The occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and Golan Heights, that's all still illegal, but even by the, you know, watered down UN resolutions. It's not legal, and yet the U.S. finances it. And American public opinion is turning. And Miko, you know, we have a minute left. People want to do something because they actually care about justice once they learn the reality, when they kind of cut through the propaganda of groups like AIPAC. What can people do? What can somebody listening to this show do with, if they want to find out about the BDS movement or get involved? What can they do?
Well, look up the BDS movement online. Look at their website. Check out the different campaigns, the different products that are on the boycott list. Make sure that their local store, their local cafeteria, their local restaurant does not buy Israeli products. Make sure that their friends and their neighbors understand why this is important. There's a terrible regime of oppression and murder of civilians that has taken over Palestine, and Palestine needs to be freed of that, and everybody can participate in their own little way, and that's how we make a difference. That's what I would recommend.
Yeah, so people can just go online and look for Boycott, Divest, Sanctions, a peaceful movement of protest. It's a global movement standing for justice for the Palestinian people.
That's right. We're going to have to leave it there, though, Brian. We were joined from Washington by Miko Peled. He's the author of The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. And he also has a new book called Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
In the first visit of high-ranking South Korean officials to North Korea since Kim Jong-un took office in 2011, South Korean National Security Office head Chung Wi-yong headed up a delegation to North Korea to discuss a potential meeting of the leaders of both Koreas. We're joined from Seattle by Simone Chun. She's a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. Simone, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
Simone, this is getting very broad play in the United States. It's incredibly important. It's the first such meeting in 10 years. It's the first such meeting with since Kim Jong-un rose to power. What do you think the reaction is going to be from the White House?
We'll have to wait and see. But so far, it looks like even President Trump also indicated in the last week that he's looking forward to talk with North Korea. So if that is true, I think that we're going to probably sounds like we're going to have a little bit brighter news than that we had in the last 7 or 8 years. And just to background, as you know, we're checking this morning the pictures that released from Blue House, Korea's president's office. And there was amazing picture of these the Korean delegates consists of, obviously National Security Advisor and also Director of National Intelligence Service, So-hoon. Both of them have a very years of experience in negotiating North Korea, and these are, they are truly the experts. And they went to North Korea on South Korea's military aircraft, and it took only obviously less than 2 hours for them to arrive in Pyongyang. And most interesting thing, but it was truly unprecedented, is that they actually met with the Kim Jong Un, with the North Korean leader, within 3 hours. So that is truly a new something that never happened before. And what I'm also hearing is that they will be also going to, they're going to report their results, the negotiation progress to Korean President Moon Jae-in. And then afterwards, they're going to come to Washington and brief American leaders and obviously including hopefully Donald Trump. So if all goes well, I think that we're going to have some major breakthrough. So that's my hope. And also, I think there is some evidence that can support the hope.
I was in a panel discussion, maybe a debate would be a better way of putting it, televised discussion about this issue about 10 days ago. And one of the people on the panel was somebody who was, I would say, not that left-wing, not that progressive, Korean-American professor who made the argument that, well, Moon Jae-in has to go slow. He can't get ahead of the Americans. He can't ignore the fact that America plays a big role in South Korean politics, so he has to go very step by step by step. And I was making the argument that I thought if any possibility of success existed, it would be based on momentum, on the fact that the North and the South and their desire for a change on the Korean Peninsula could create a new set of circumstances, new facts on the ground, so to speak, that would give those who favor a thaw, those who favor reconciliation or a detente or a rapprochement, whatever word we want to use, a chance to show what they have going for them, because there are lots of forces both inside the South Korean military establishment and even more so within the Pentagon, within the CIA, within the U.S. military industrial complex, who would actually be upset by peace breaking out between the two Koreas. Anyway, what's your take on that?
I think all those four is, the points that you made, I think it's a good one. First of all, it is, just reality in international politics that without U.S. involvement, really, really, you know, either, you know, nothing can be done and very few things can be done. It's just reality. So especially in the Korean context, in U.S. role is the key. And also, just the fact that all the previous inter-Korean negotiation or talk was also held with some kind of support or from initiative from the United States. So it is U.S. role is very important. I think it's very important, yes, to go step by step. On the other hand, the point that you're making is also good, the momentum. This is the first time, actually, in a very few opportunities that we have had that it's a major momentum. It's very fast track and it's very, very, you know, accelerated process. I think what is here is that the important thing is that, you know, South Korean team, you know, the Moon Jae-in team, the foreign policy team, especially with the high-level delegation in North Korea, these guys are really truly experienced. This is not some ad hoc, you know, inexperienced bureaucrat. They have years of experience, 20 or 30 years of experience in dealing in North Korea. So I think that we have actually truly a dream team. And third is about North Korea point of view. You know, North Korea has been so isolated, especially under Kim Jong-un. I think that they're actually trying to see, know more about Trump administration. And so I think they're trying to know more about Trump administration's motive and you know, their rationale behind all this, you know, propaganda through South Korea. That can be only genuine talk can, you know, can only held within sort of in person-to-person sort of a meeting, such as happening right now. And the last thing that I want to also point out is that among you know, a lot of South Koreans, especially the leaders who have the years of experience engaging North Korea, says, you know what, North Korea may, Kim Jong-un may say that it is actually because, you know, Americans and also South Koreans also very interested in getting some kind of commitment from North Korea about the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. So this time, some are arguing that Kim Jong-un might say it is actually the will of, you know, his grandfather and of his father, you know, that, you know, Korean Peninsula should be denuclearized. So, you know, in Korea, you have to understand that the culture is very important, you know, ancestral worship culture. And if he's loyal to his grandfather's and father's wishes, it is also him who also should be, you know, very, very faithful to carry out that the peace, you know, path toward denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula and also eventually, obviously, the peace. But the most important thing is, I think, the you know, is basically to end some kind of or reduce U.S. hostility toward North Korea. I think that is the most important. That is the bottom line. And I think that's also what a lot of activists in the United States and also South Korea are trying to do.
Yeah, that's a subject, John, that I want to come back to in the short few minutes that we have. But before we do that, Professor Simone Chan is our guest. Professor Chan, it was the United States that introduced nuclear weapons into the Korean Peninsula. I think people don't know that, but it was actually the U.S. military that brought them to South Korea. Talk about that history a little bit.
Yes, you know, if you look at it, North Korea has been, or the entire Korean Peninsula has been U.S. nuclear threat obviously, the next 60 years. And it was the United States who immediately brought the, you know, not only nuclear, you know, threat itself, but also technical nuclear weapons. And the only, it was, you know, in the early 1990s, you know, George W. Bush, who agreed to, you know, at the time of the, you know, collapse of Soviet Union and the end of Cold War, they withdrew this technical nuclear weapons. And if you look at it, really, there is a very interesting study that shows that, you know, pretty much North Korea's nuclear weapon was, you know, the plan was developed because of specifically addressing, trying to address to the threat of the United States. And also research has also shown that when the United States' threat to North Korea is reduced or there is some kind of a dialogue negotiation, North Korea's pursuit of nuclear weapon and also into, you know, ICBM's missile program was also halted or, you know, slowed down. So if you think all this, if you look at all these factors into consideration, I think that the idea, Americans' idea that North Korea is pursuing nuclear weapon because to trying to, you know, have war against the United States, that has to be really corrected. And this is, I think, amazing, great opportunity that we can make for the first time, really, as you mentioned, you know, North and South Korea meeting for the first time, actually literally in 11 years. And this time with the, especially with the, you know, the Trump administration's elections coming in November, if Trump can have some kind of major breakthrough and help the Korean peace process, I think it will also benefit United States. And furthermore, I think that it's important, you know, this is actually, I want to tell something that not many Americans hear. You know, Koreans have, the Koreans do not, a lot of Americans think North Korea has this, this kind of a very strong animosity toward the United States. That is true. But the thing is, all this started, North Korean regime started because of the anti-Japanese, anti-Japanese colonization struggle, right? So that was at the time, if you remember, a lot of Koreans, you know, who was living under Japanese colonization, they were actually thinking, you know, a lot of time, well, maybe Americans can also help us to liberate, you know, the Japanese colonization. So the point that I'm making is there's a very, even in North Korea, probably, you know, Koreans from my mother's, my father's generation, who really have a still very different idea about what America is. And there are some of the positive memory of the United States. Yeah. So I think that this time we have to really, you know, sort of destroy this propaganda made about against North Korea. And the bottom line is, if the United States can end the its hostility toward North Korea, I think the genuine sort of a foundation for progress will be made.
I agree with Professor Chun. Only the United States can give North Korea what it needs in order to come to the table, which is a security guarantee. The U.S. routinely, regularly deployed nuclear weapons between 1958 and 1991. They were the ones who brought them. North Korea wants a security guarantee. I believe that if the U.S. granted a security guarantee to the North Koreans, meaning that there was not going to be regime change efforts, there would be absolute reciprocation on the part of the DPRK.
I think that would be an utter game changer. I really do. And who knows? Donald Trump doesn't appear to have a policy. Maybe Donald Trump can be the one to actually enact this policy. We'll see. We're out of time, though. We were joined from Seattle by Simone Chun. She's a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We will be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Venezuela's presidential election, which had been scheduled for late April, has been postponed until May 20th as a faction of the opposition breaks ranks and decides to participate. Will the country's Bolivarian revolution continue its streak of electoral success? Can the country overcome economic turmoil? We're joined from Caracas, Venezuela by Lucas Kerner. He is an activist and writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Lucas, welcome back.
Great to be here.
Lucas, this was kind of a surprise announcement, no?
Absolutely. This was completely unexpected. From what we knew, April 22nd elections were on track, but a surprise agreement was reached with the faction of the opposition as of Thursday, which moved the elections to May 20th with a host of new electoral guarantees. In fact, the leader of the main opposition party backing the principal opposition contender, Henry Falcon, the Progressive Alliance Party, has said that the guarantees, you know, would effectively safeguard the rights of Venezuelans to participate in the election and have their votes counted and respected. So it definitely is a very significant agreement.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the New York Times from March 5th. I mean, this is only 4 days ago. And the headline is Venezuela delays presidential vote, but opposition still plans a boycott. Talk about that, if you would, and who's not going to participate and whether the New York Times just kind of jumped the gun here.
Yeah, let's rewind. The main opposition coalition known as the Democratic Unity Roundtable announced last month that it would boycott the April 22nd elections, claiming that the date was too early, that the conditions were not there for it to be a free and fair election, even though that date was actually fixed in the course of negotiations with the government that took place between around November and January. And, you know, the opposition was pushing for May and the government wanted March, and April was supposed to be the compromise, according to facilitator and lead mediator Jose Luis Zapatero, the former Spanish president. However, the opposition, you know, despite seemingly getting what it wanted and also a number of other guarantees and agreement, you know, that have been even further bolstered in this current agreement, which now includes a UN, not only a UN observation mission, but an invitation to the vehemently anti-Maduro head of the Organization of American States, Luis Almagro, but also equal access to private and public national and international media, which was also another important opposition demand, as well as reopening the electoral registry to safeguard registration both inside Venezuela and outside Venezuela, which definitely benefits the opposition. So despite, you know, actually gaining more of its demands met, you know, with this new agreement, the opposition has nonetheless, you know, rejected the agreement. And, you know, last week we saw that it formally excommunicated Henry Falcón, the opposition front runner, for daring to participate in this election. In fact, according to Mark Weisbrot, and inside sources within the Trump administration have said that, you know, Henry Falcón was actually approached by the U.S. and threatened with financial sanctions if he were to participate in the election. So clearly there is immense pressure on the part of the major opposition parties, Democratic Action, the very far right wing Popular Will Party, and the First Justice Party, which are very closely aligned with Washington, as well, you know, as the Trump administration, to delegitimize this election, no matter what the guarantees are on the table.
Lucas, you actually answered the question that I was going to ask, but I'm going to ask it anyway, because I think we ought to get a little bit deeper into this. Here you have the opposition negotiating with the government. The government essentially agrees to all of the opposition's demands. The election is delayed until the end of May, giving all parties ample opportunity to campaign and to plan their get-out-the-vote drives. But then the major parties in the opposition announced that they're not going to participate in the election. They're going to boycott the election. I was going to ask you specifically if that was because of U.S. pressure. And I think it is. I think it's kind of, it's pretty clear that it is. But then what do the Venezuelans do? If there are outside observers, international election observers, and they certify that this is a democratic election, which I think they probably will because they've been invited in the first place, where does that leave the U.S.? And then what happens vis-a-vis the U.S. pressure to the right-wing opposition in the country?
Well, yeah, I think that there's definitely a, you know, confluence of different motivations here. Because on the opposition side, there definitely is a U.S. pressure, but I think there's also the case that the major opposition parties have much more to lose by participating in the election and losing, and thereby being forced to recognize the result of the election, than just boycotting it straight away. And then remember that these large opposition parties have you know, by and large over the past, you know, 2 years have favored an openly insurrectionary strategy against the government of seeking to overthrow it through violent anti-government protests. They claimed over 100 lives last year, as well as you know, a very public campaign to encourage international sanctions, both against targeted sanctions against individuals and, you know, economic sanctions, you know, against the country, that have had a devastating impact on the already severe economic crisis that Venezuela is going through right now. So there definitely is, from their point of view, that to, you know, win, even to win an election, you know, that would mean having to pass through the existing institutional framework. And, you know, basically it would be a negotiated transition in any case. They prefer a much more radical rupture in which they can dictate the terms. And, you know, much like we saw on April 11, 2002, when, you know, many of the same opposition leaders, Julio Borges, Leopoldo López, Henrique Capriles, who were all the opposition's, you know, front runners, you know, who would like to, you know, be president, they led a coup against the government that was blessed by the United States, that was blessed by the New York Times. So clearly, I mean, there's that going on. And, you know, in terms of the international scene, the United States is going to boycott the Lima Group, which is conformed by 12 conservative countries in the hemisphere, Canada, Peru, Colombia, Brazil, Argentina, a number of these countries that actually have very severe, you know, doubts regarding their democratic legitimacy in the case of Brazil or even the case of Mexico. But I mean, I think it's very clear that these countries are going to follow suit and likely, you know, boycott, you know, continue to reject the results of this election, you know, notwithstanding the important agreement that has been reached. I mean, we'll see if there's any fractures that occur within that coalition. But nonetheless, I think that the situation of international isolation against Caracas is likely to persist.
Yeah, John, let's really help the audience dissect what's going on, because there's so much BS. That's bad sociology in American media about meddling in other countries' elections.
Oh, yeah.
Like right now, The Russians are all about, you know, the media, the Russiagate, the witch hunt hysteria here is because they say a troll farm in St. Petersburg bought Facebook ads, 56% of which took place after the election, blah, blah, blah. They weren't advocating a particular candidate. But here we have congressional investigations and the media is going whole hog about Russia interfering in our democracy. But here you have a situation where the Maduro government and its parties, which lost the parliamentary election and accepted the outcome of the election results, is basically trying to convince its opposition to participate in an electoral process, inviting in international observers, inviting all kinds of checks and safeguards to make sure that this is a free and fair election, which most of the Venezuelan elections have been determined to be. I mean, I think maybe all of them. And here you have the American government and both parties saying to the opposition, don't you dare participate in an electoral contest with the Maduro government, because ultimately they don't want democracy in Venezuela. What they want is regime change in Venezuela. And they'll use any means, whether it's covert operations or an election, doesn't matter. But that's the deal.
And I want to add something to that, too. I consider myself to be quite a typical American on the issue of Venezuela, in that I really don't know very much about the inner workings of the country. But then when I see articles like this in the New York Times that you mentioned, this New York Times article of March the 1st, even I can see through some of the language in this New York Times article. I think you're right, Brian. I think it's clear that the U.S. government, and it doesn't matter if it's headed by Donald Trump or Barack Obama, wants regime change in this country and is just pretending that that's an appropriate and normal response from a large government like ours.
Lucas Kerner is our guest. Go ahead, Lucas.
You know, I just want to jump in and say, I just want to really underline the bipartisan nature of the U.S. policy on Venezuela, as you're alluding to, that when you look at, you know, Trump's most recent move on Friday to renew the Obama-era designation of Venezuela as an unusual and extraordinary threat to U.S. national security, which basically authorizes U.S. sanctions against the country. I mean, that's a key move. But also, we saw last week the U.S. Senate Democrats coming out, passing a resolution basically obliging the Congress not to recognize the results of Venezuela's elections unless it was postponed and unless a whole host of conditions were met. You know, conditions, by the way, which were not imposed on Honduras, an election that has openly been declared fraudulent even by the OAS's Luis Almagro. But, you know, even Bernie Sanders signed this resolution, we should point out that. And, you know, secondly, this is even an election that, you know, the conservative data analysis poll and, you know, many other pollsters have shown that the opposition has a very good chance of winning. You know, the projections out of that say that, you know, Henry Falcón will defeat Nicolás Maduro by 7 points. So why is it that, you know, even in a context of election that the opposition is very likely to win, the United States is doing everything in its everything possible to, you know, effectively delegitimize the election?
It's because they don't want elections. And unfortunately, we're out of time. Lucas Kerner joining us from Venezuela. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time for this hour. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can also follow us on Twitter at loudclearradio.com. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.